Hello, it's Thursday, May the 20th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up... Friends, did you watch it? Well, 17 years after the first episode, they're coming back with the original cast, including, of course, Jennifer Aniston. The extraordinary investigation into how Martin Bashir secured that landmark interview with Princess Diana, it must rank as one of the darkest days in the history of the BBC. More and more confusion and chaos about holidays, with the Prime Minister saying families should only visit countries on the amber list in extreme circumstances. But first, why, oh why, are one in five kids in this country obese by the time they get to primary school? A staggering one in five children are obese by the time they leave primary school. And a new BBC TV show investigates whether it's due to the rise of ultra-processed food. For children, ultra-processed foods, think fish fingers and microwave meals, account for 64% of the calories they consume. Dr. Chris Van Tulleken ate a diet of 80% UPFs, as they're known, for a month. And guess what? He gained a stone, developed heartburn, and felt addicted to additives. He joins me now. Dr. Chris, I hope you're not still addicted. Have you gone back to proper healthy food again?
What was really good about my diet, Andrew, is that whilst I was overeating all this, I was interviewing all these amazing experts around the world who were telling me how it was made and what it was doing to me. And so by the end, it was really easy to stop eating it. So I'm now, it took a few weeks, and now I almost can't eat it, actually.
And the trouble is, do you think parents who feed their children this stuff, do you think they understand just how bad it is for them?
It would be almost impossible for a parent in this country to understand, because our UK nutritional guidance doesn't incorporate this concept of ultra-processing. So there's a long scientific definition which is formally accepted by the United Nations, by governments around the world. We haven't accepted it yet, so people don't know about it, which is why I made the program. But it boils down to, if it's wrapped in plastic and has an ingredient you don't have in your kitchen, like maltodextrin or soy lecithin or flavorings or things like that, then it is UPF. In fact, you said fish fingers. Not all fish fingers are ultra processed. There are lots of fish fingers out there that don't have
good, because I eat some
fish.
I buy them in Waitrose.
They're fine, and I feed them to my kids.
Right. Okay. So for parents, this is a wake up call, isn't it? Chris, they know, don't they, doctors? Because they know, they can see with their own eyes that their children are overweight, or perhaps they don't see that.
I think at the moment we are in the state with ultra-processed foods that we were with smoking in the 1950s. It is part of our environment. So this is our food environment. If you go to fancy shops, if you go to delis, if you go to the, you know, we can all imagine the kind of places I'm talking about on the high street that sell you a really nice organic sandwich. Much of that is ultra-processed. Your whole grain granary loaves, they're ultra-processed. This food is all around us, and it's engineered to drive overeating because it's engineered for profit. And so I really strongly feel there is no personal responsibility here. We're all just swimming in this sea trying to eat well. But when I'm in the hospital, it is, I would say, impossible for me to eat a lunch of whole food. It simply isn't possible. I can try and leave, but even if I go out and get a sandwich, it will still be ultra processed. And that's why this food is delicious and we eat more of it.
Yeah. Do you know, I remember waiting for a friend who was in a hospital up in Yorkshire, and I saw various NHS staff going into the supermarket where they were buying their lunch. Mm-hmm. And I was struck by how overweight most of the NHS staff were. They were ancillary staff. Some of them had medical uniforms on. When I wandered around that supermarket, I thought, where's the healthy food? There wasn't much.
Yeah.
So even in a hospital, they're selling this old rubbish.
They are, and much of it is not branded as rubbish. It's branded as a weight loss solution. Many of the snacks are kind of baked or low fat, and much of it is the sort of organic luxury things that we buy in the, you know, those of us with money and resources do buy in fancy places. So it's really everywhere. But low income jobs and families are disproportionately affected because this food is really cheap. And
it's cheap because
of the way it's made. And it's got a long shelf life, and so it can be sold at rock bottom price. You know, fresh fruit and veg, they're not very expensive when you buy them, but you have to throw them away. You can only keep them a few days. The supply chain is complicated, and you have to cook them.
And also the other thing, of course, with this cheap food, it's also often you can put it in the microwave or put it in the oven, 20 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it takes, done and dusted. And if you're a busy mum or a busy dad, that's an added convenience for you.
Until I made this program, I would frequently microwave the kids' lasagna because, you know, it's easy. And, you know, we're very lucky. We afford childcare. We've got a nursery that runs over hours. If you're on a 0 hours contract, and you don't, you know, you're not lucky enough to have a medical degree and lots of resources, it's really complicated for families on low income. So this really is not a personal responsibility argument any more than smoking rates in the 1950s were. This needs regulation. At the moment, our food education, whether you're a doctor, a nurse, or a human, all your information about food is largely controlled by the companies that make it, and that has to change.
So that's the point. I mean, what has to change? What would you want to see happen now, Dr. Chris, as a result of this pretty shocking study that you've done?
I think understanding the magnitude of the problem is the first thing. Incorporating the definition of ultra-processing into our guidance, and a realization that it isn't simply about food that is high in fat, salt, sugar. That food has been on our plates for centuries. It's about this industrial processing. It's about foods that are engineered to drive overeating. Those are the ultra-processed ones. Putting it in our nutritional guidance, limiting the influence of, there are really about 10 companies that make this stuff, limiting their influence on particularly children, but all of us. Regulation of the marketing is the number one step. And the government's made a great step in the first direction. So they've said, you know, junk food advertising online, you know, that is a really powerful step. But what you'll see is much of the food that is ultra processed, that drives weight gain, isn't counted as junk food. And there are lots of ways around. If you make a breakfast cereal that's full of sugar, you can actually, by putting a small portion size on the pack, you can say that it isn't very high sugar. But if you actually weigh out a single portion, it's only a tiny handful. So there are ways around the current definition that the food companies are very sophisticated at dealing with. But they lobby, they have immense power of advertising, and they have saturated our food supply system with this cheap food. So everything from the way we farm to the way we subsidize crops and the way we educate our healthcare professionals has to change. So if I look up a scientific paper on anything nutritional, it is very likely to be funded by a food company. And there is this tiny core of scientists who are independent, who do amazing work, but they are very badly funded. They're very, and their voice is relatively small. And so that one of the things about the program is to give voice to those scientists, the team in Brazil, and the team in the States, the National Institutes of Health, and of course the team at my own hospital at UCLH.
Just finally, I was quite interested about the additives. Are they addictive, some of the additives they put in this food?
So one of the things that everyone is trying to do is go, what is the one thing about ultra-processed that drives you to eat more? And this is a constructed product, okay? So it's a bit like your phone. You know there's a thing, I don't know what kind of phone you've got, but my phone is, I have quite an addicted relationship with my phone. And it's not one thing about the phone. It's not the internet or the camera or the apps or anything. It's the whole package. And ultra-processed food has just been engineered over many decades by these really sophisticated engineers who take it to a focus group, perfect it, sell it, bring it back to the lab, re-perfect it, market it, and they're perfecting everything from the acoustics of the packs and the bottles to the pictures on those packs to the textures. And so it's not one thing. The additives do create often an addictive sensation, particularly the flavorings, but many of the additives are about shelf life or about price. So there's lots of different parts of the food that create an experience which makes it very, very hard to put down. And you find, you know, when was the last time you just left half a sandwich that you bought at a fancy place on the side? When was the last time you ate half a pack of crisps? You know, it can't be done.
No, indeed. Fascinating stuff. That's Dr. Chris van Tulleken, whose programme, What Are We Feeding Our Kids? All to do with the rise of ultra-processed food, is broadcast on BBC One tonight at 9 p.m. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. And remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So Martin Bashir commissioned fake bank statements and used what is described as deceitful behaviour in a serious breach of the BBC's producer guidelines to secure his landmark Panorama interview with the Princess of Wales. According to that official inquiry, which came out, the report was published at 2 o'clock today. In response to the findings of Lord Dyson, he's a former master of the rolls, a very senior judge, Martin Bashir has apologised. He says the faking of bank statements was an action I deeply regret, but felt it had no bearing whatsoever on the personal choice by Princess Diana to take part in the interview. Now, somebody who knows the royal family rather well and the BBC rather well is Michael Cole, who is, of course, a former BBC television journalist and was royal correspondent for the BBC. Michael, you and I have known each other for a very long time. This must be the darkest day, I would argue, in the BBC's modern history.
You've taken the words out of my mouth. It's a very, very black day, and I can think of none blacker. This is damning stuff, Andrew, damning stuff. This BBC, for 99 years, been broadcasting to the world, built on the bedrock of integrity and telling truth to the nation in times of peace and in times of war, and to be exposed in this way by the president, former president of the appeal court, Lord Dyson, is a shaming moment. The present director general, Tim Davey, is right to give or offer to us a full and unconditional apology, because quite frankly, there's nothing else he can do, because the catalogue of errors and misjudgments in outlined by this report is utterly damning. And you've mentioned Mr. Bashir, who I know reasonably well, his response to it, saying indeed, he said that he was immensely proud of the interview. Mm. Well, I think he rather gives himself airs here, because this is displaying a rather strange or warped sense of personal integrity, because besides the bank statements, the faked bank statements, for which a man lost his job,
indeed.
Had to get out.
Yeah.
Matt Wiesler, a South African talented man in television graphics, quietly and silently blacklisted by Tony Hall at the BBC, never work at the BBC again. That man lost his livelihood and had to go off to Devon to make a living however he could. And he was only following the instructions, the precise instructions of Martin Bashir, to cod up these bank statements. But it wasn't just the bank statements, of course. It was the other allegations, which turned out to be totally untrue, that were fed into Diana's brother, Lord Spencer, Charles Spencer, and were instrumental, or certainly unknown to her, and certainly supported the feelings of paranoia. I mean, there were many things that Diana believed that she was absolutely right about, but I know from my certain knowledge that she did believe that her telephone conversations were being bugged. She did believe that her movements were being reported back to her husband, and she did believe that her life was under threat. But he played upon those fears and brought in what was called the interview of the century. Well, 26 years later, almost, we find out really what went on behind the scenes.
And there's another element too here, Michael, because Tony Hall was the director of news at the time. He conducted an inquiry into what went on, and he concluded that Martin Bashir was an honest man. He'd done nothing wrong, and he described him as an honest man. Now, Lord Dyson, in his report, says that report was woefully inadequate. It was a cover-up. That's what it was. It was a whitewash. Tony Hall then left the BBC, went off to run the Royal Opera House, as you do. He came back to the BBC as the all-powerful Director General, and now he's got a very nice sinecure at the National Gallery. He has a lot of apologising to do, and I wonder how long he can hang on to that job at the National Gallery. Why would donors. Part of his job is to bring charitable donations into the gallery. Why would they want to give any money to a man like that?
Yes, well, I know Tony quite well, of course, one of the great and the good, and he was my boss when I worked on the 6 o'clock news, and I know him socially as well. And from what the statement I've heard from him, he seems to believe that that his integrity hasn't been called into question, that he's got Alf scot-free. But it is undoubtedly true. He not just only exonerated Bashir, he praised him for what he did. And I think this actually calls into question his judgment. You know, I haven't read the 127 pages of this report. I haven't seen them. But I believe that many people who in Panorama, in Current Affairs at that time, gave evidence to Lord Dyson about what went on and how things were handled, and also how people who were working for Panorama wanted to bring this and did bring this to the attention of the editorship of the programme and were told that they were troublemakers, and indeed there's evidence that they were picked off one by one, in other words, gotten rid of, so they could cause no further trouble. Well, this is, you know, this is all mafia stuff, rather than the BBC in its higher councils talking in this way. I mean, hanging out Matt Wiesler to dry and sacking or getting rid of reporters who wanted to questionable, indeed incorrect practices, which have now been revealed. The code of conduct for producers, there was a clear laid down tariff of what people did, and serious breaches of the producer guidelines took place. And the people who knew at the top actually knew about it and covered it up. And as we all know, going back to Watergate and before, it's the cover-up that is more serious in the end than the actual offence.
And just finally, Michael, it can be argued, I think, without a doubt, that interview set in train a series of events. So the Queen wrote to Prince Charles and Diana saying, please divorce. They got divorced. The Princess of Wales was then removed effectively from the royal family. She had no royal protection officers. When she was driven into that Paris underpass, there were no royal protection officers to prevent a drunk driver being behind the wheel of the car or even perhaps insisting she had her seatbelt on. I'm not saying that interview killed the Princess of Wales, but it was a trigger for a series of events that led to the Paris underpass.
Prince Charles got married because his father told him to, and he got divorced because his mother told him to. And what triggered that was the interview by Martin Bashir, because notwithstanding what came out about in the marriage, the moment when the hair stood up on the back of my neck, Andrew, truly, and I thought, oh my goodness, what she said was when she said, my husband isn't up to the top job, he's not fit to be king, and indeed he doesn't want to be. Well, when I heard that, I heard the executioner's axe being sharpened at the same time, because in an earlier age, that would have been regarded as lèse majesté and treason. So that was a terrible, terrible moment, because it's possible that they could have soldiered on. It might have been difficult, but they were only separated at that time. And, of course, the princess continued to live within the confines of Kensington Palace, which gave her a great degree of protection. Mm. She got rid of her protection provided by Scotland Yard because she did believe that they were reporting back on her movements to her husband, and she didn't want that. But I think it is not unrealistic and not unfair for you to say that interview did set in train the events which ended in the Alma Tunnel on the 31st of August 1997.
Indeed. That's Michael Cole, former BBC television journalist and royal correspondent for the BBC. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe, and then you can get access to all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at Toryboypierce. The Prime Minister says families should visit medium-risk destinations only in extreme circumstances and not for holidays. Predictably, there's been an angry response from travel industry bosses and total and utter confusion from people thinking of going on holiday. Around 5 million Britons are understood to have booked amber list breaks this summer, just 12 destinations are green, with most in remote parts of the world or with strict entry measures in place or places that nobody wants to visit, like the Falkland Islands. I'm joined now by Ryan Howsam, who's founder and chairman of UK travel insurer Stayshore. Mr. Howsam, are you any the wiser what is going on? They create an amber list of countries which we think, well, we can go there on holiday. We just know we'll have to quarantine when we get back. And then we're told, no, we can't.
Well, no, I don't think anybody is. I mean, the communications coming out of the government is, I think it's ludicrous, really. I mean, it's almost impossible. I think one of the biggest problems is the fact that the SCDO list, which you may or may not be aware, is the list that the government says is not safe to travel to, doesn't match with the traffic light system.
Oh.
So that creates a huge amount of confusion. So, for example, if you take some islands in Greece, they're not on the SCDO don't go to list, but yet you can, they're on the amber list, so you can go. So it's an absolute minefield. So I think the biggest problem is that there's no real one-stop shop for information.
No.
And what you're really seeing is that it's coming out from all different people with lots of different confusing messages. And I think it's almost impossible for the consumer.
And of course, it depends which government you speak to. So you have the Welsh secretary telling us that actually he thinks having a holiday abroad is an essential need. You have the health secretary in the House of Lords, a complete idiot called Lord, his name will come to me in a moment, saying that you can't even go to green list holidays, saying travel is dangerous. Stay at home.
Well, I mean, this is the major problem. I mean, as far as we're concerned, it's if it's an amber list country, it's not against the law. It was against the law. It's now not against the law. So you're free to travel as long as you follow the guidelines. But then you heard Boris Johnson in Parliament the other day basically say you shouldn't go unless it's an emergency and so on. But then there's no official guideline saying that. It's just a pampering to say whatever they want to say at the time that seems to make sense in that interview, but there's no coordination at all across the messaging. And you can imagine for the travel industry, it's absolute chaos. I mean, people have no idea what to do. And then on top of that, you've got, the cost of the PCR testing. The government should be heavily involved to get this discounted. I mean, if you take some of them are like about £120-130 and you need four of them, you've got, £600 per person in some cases for a test. So it's really difficult.
It's and for a company like yours as well, Mr. Howsam, I guess a lot of people they're trying to insure holidays, but you presumably can't insure against whether people, if for instance, if somebody's insured themselves for a holiday, then they hear the Prime Minister say, we don't want you to go to amber list countries, but they've already booked the holiday. Would your insurance cover them cancelling that holiday? Presumably not, because they can legally still go.
Yeah, this is the point. Unless it's illegal to go, at that point, I mean, when they book, it's legal to go. So at that point, if they make a decision that they don't want to go, then they wouldn't be covered because they're making a decision themselves. It's not that they've been told you can't go. So there are two very different things. But I think it's important that when you're getting a policy or actually a travel a holiday, that you've got an awful lot of flexibility built in to be able to do what you want to do, which is what we do to help people.
What is your advice to people listening to this who are just completely baffled? I've remembered the name of the health minister in the House of Lords, but it's Lord Bethel. He used to run raves at Ministry of Sound. Great qualification to be a health minister, of course.
I think, first of all, make sure that you're booking with a reputable company. That's the first thing. I'm talking about the holiday there, and exactly the same for insurance. We offer flexibility. In other words, if you want to change your policy dates, we'll do that free of charge. And I think another one that a lot of people don't realise this is that we actually cover for travelling against SCDO advice. So that basically means if the government say, we don't think you should go there, not you can't, but we don't think you should go there, like an amber or a red list country, with us, this is just in Europe, then we will actually cover that with an add-on. And that's an important thing. So make sure you get that with your policy. And when you're booking, particularly for cancellation, as soon as you book, get travel insurance so you're covered for cancellation, and then also make sure that the policy that you've got will cover you for all COVID-related matters, whether that's before for cancellation. So, for example, with our policy, if you contract COVID or indeed one of your relatives contacts, you know, somebody you're in close proximity with contracts COVID and you haven't, you've got the ability to claim for that. And then in addition to that, you've got the ability for medical in resort. And these are really, really important things.
Very good advice. Are you daring to go on holiday this year? Are you worried that wherever you're thinking of going, maybe end up on a red list?
Well, actually, I'm currently abroad now. I'm in Spain, so
very nice.
You know, it feels pretty normal here at the moment. So,
does the Prime Minister know you're not supposed to be there? You know, unless it's essential.
Absolutely, I'm not supposed to. Exactly.
There we are. Well, I have to tell you, Mr. Housman, it's why I'm staying at home this year. I just can't face any of all this, and the thoughts of hours at an airport, that's it. It's staycation for me.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, there's a lot of people that want to get away. And
I understand that.
You know, I mean, the damage they're doing to the industry is irreparable.
Huge.
I mean, you know, we're okay, but, some of these big companies, like us, and even bigger companies are in serious trouble. So, you know, they need to do something and get the communications better. I mean, it's a real shambles.
Absolutely. That's Ryan Housen, founder and chairman of the UK travel insurer Stayshore, with some very, very sound advice if you are booking a holiday abroad. Business editor Ruth Sundlands here with the latest headlines. Now, Ruth, it's all to do with the Chinese, but the price of Bitcoin has dived. Now, all I know about Bitcoin is it sounds rather like voodoo economics to me. Can you explain what Bitcoin is and why the price goes up so high and then down so quickly, so low?
Well, Bitcoin is a digital currency. It was created back in January 2009. Nobody quite knows who by. The person concerned goes by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto.
Right.
We don't quite know who he or she is. It's all a little bit of a mystery. And there's a limited number of Bitcoin, and they are a type of cryptocurrency, really. There are no coins. There are no actual coins. It's all virtual. They're just balances that are kept on ledgers, and you can go mining for if you're very clever at computer, and but it's way beyond me. I won't pretend to know how you go about mining them. If you're very clever in that way, you can mine. There's a finite amount of bitcoins, or you can just buy them from Bitcoin exchanges. Now, they have been extremely volatile. They have shot up recently, but then earlier this week, on Wednesday, in fact yesterday, they suffered one of the most severe crashes that they've had in the history of Bitcoin. They were down by about 30%, and this is because the Chinese central bank decided to have a crackdown on Bitcoin. So that was why they've bounced back a little bit again today. But Bank of China was saying that they didn't want financial institutions accepting Bitcoin or other similar cryptocurrencies as payments. And they're just concerned, really, about the level of volatility. Now, the Bank of England, other central banks have got similar concerns and have warned people about investing or buying. Investing is possibly the wrong word. You know, maybe gambling is a better word on Bitcoin.
So if the Chinese do this, I mean, the Chinese are very powerful players in the international markets, of course, now, Ruth. Does that mean, are we seeing the end of Bitcoin, do you think?
I don't think it will be the end of Bitcoin. Bitcoin's got some powerful backers and influential backers, including Elon Musk of Tesla. He's got a lot of Bitcoin, and he signaled today part of the reason that it's rebounded, it's recovered. So Bitcoin fell to below $31,000. So that's around half its all-time high that it hit in mid-April. It's back around $40,000 today. And part of the reason for that is that Elon Musk has been on Twitter. He's been flashing up diamond hand emojis. Now, that's a signal saying that he's not going to sell his holdings of Bitcoin. So that shored it up. I think Bitcoin, it's not finished. There's a lot of interest in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies as they're called. I think what's not very clear is where are they going. So at first they were very popular as a sort of dark currency, you know, with money launderers and all this sort of thing. They've gained a bit of legitimacy, but they still haven't got to the point where they're a currency as we would normally understand it, as in widely acceptable in terms of paying for goods and services. You know, you can't just walk in a shop with some Bitcoin yet. Maybe one day you'll be able to do that. And nor are they a reliable store of value, which is another characteristic of a conventional currency as we know it. You know, the pound in your pocket, well, notwithstanding inflation and other threats, the pound in your pocket's worth a pound. You know, the Bitcoin in your virtual ledger, its value veers up and down quite wildly at the moment. So Bitcoin's still in its infancy. I guess we've had pounds a very, very long time, haven't we? Only had Bitcoin since 2009, so it's an evolving digital currency.
I think I'm going to stick to premium bonds, Ruth.
Do you know what? That might be a wise idea. I think I'm with you. I don't own Bitcoin. It's too much for me. I think if you want to get into Bitcoin, just treat it as a little bit of fun. Don't put any money into Bitcoin that you can't afford to lose. I think definitely be careful.
Very good advice as ever from our business editor, Ruth Sundon. The beloved sitcom Friends, not beloved by me, I've got a confession, I've never seen it, is returning to our screens this summer with a special reunion episode with the original stars, although they're going to appear as themselves, not as their characters. A trailer released yesterday shows them returning to the original studios 17 years after the first episode aired. The reunion will air on the US streaming service HBO Max on May 27th, but as yet, there's no UK release date. I'm joined by Eleanor Sharples, TV and radio reporter for the Daily Mail. Eleanor, Jennifer Aniston's all I know about Friends. She still looks pretty damn good 17 years on from that first episode.
She really, really does. I'm with you there, Andrew. I have got to confess, I haven't really seen it either.
What?
I know. And so many of my friends have been like, I cannot believe you haven't seen it. It was like the big hit, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s. But yeah, no, the trailer looked fantastic yesterday. I think fans have been obviously going wild on social media as well, which is no surprise, bearing in mind it has been so, so long.
And are they doing it because the cast are all desperate for work and can't find anything else? Or have they all been hugely successful? I know Jennifer Aniston's done a lot of what you'd call rom-coms and things like that, but she's never scaled the heights of her ex-lover Brad Pitt, has she?
No, but she, yeah, you're quite right. She has done quite a number of films. And also David Schwimmer has as well.
That's true.
He's done really well since. But no, it'll just be... Just from watching the trailer and kind of getting a flavour of what it's about, like they go and revisit obviously the set in the studio where it took place, and you know, where they obviously spent so much time together. But it really does, well, it seemed to come across in the trailer that they are good friends. So
right.
I bet for them it's really nice.
And they're coming back as themselves. I don't quite understand that. So are they coming back not as the characters they played 17 years ago? She's coming back as Jennifer Aniston, is she? So are they all coming back as actors and actresses?
So they're coming back as themselves to kind of reminisce, I guess, about the series, the hit. And I think also from the trailer, you get a sense that they're going to reenact some of the famous scenes from the show. So I think one of them was they recreate this famous quiz that saw the girls lose their apartment to the boys.
Right.
And it sees like David Schwimmer asking questions to the other castmates about some of the memorable moments across all the episodes. So kind of reenacting different bits. You also see them doing like a rerun of a script read through, obviously doing it now instead of as they, you know, did when they must have auditioned way back when. So they very much come back as themselves and not like in character. It's not like they're just doing a special episode. It's like a special reunion episode.
Right. And just remind me, Eleanor, was it a bigger hit in America than in the UK? I know it ran for years.
It did, yeah. I would say so. Because it is an American show, and I mean, it was it went on for 10 years, but I honestly would say it's like still as popular now, in the sense of bearing in mind how much TV we have available to
watch.
Yeah,
of course. That
it's still popular on Netflix. You know, if people really want to get into a series and, you know, word of mouth, everyone's like, oh my God, Friends was amazing back in the day. But, you know, people still want to pick it up. One of my friends actually did say not so long ago that she just finished like binge watching it all. So it's, yeah, really, really popular. Really popular.
And before we see this new episode, are you going to catch up on what you've missed, or like me, you're going to completely ignore it?
Do you know, I think I'm going to completely ignore it. Just with so much else to watch, 100% will be watching the reunion show, of course. But yeah. I don't know if I can fit in 10 years worth of episodes, but as well as watching the things coming out.
But you will watch the first episode when it does come here. You'll have
definitely,
to do your job.
Yes.
They'll make you.
I will, absolutely.
And will you come back and tell us what it's all about? Because I suspect I'll give it a miss again.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, then.
I thought that'd be great.
We love Eleanor Sharples, TV and radio reporter for the Daily Mail, talking about the return after 17 years of Friends. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.